Hello, good morning and welcome. I'm Alec Hogg and this is Monday the 4th of November, one day out from the US election, which has had most people in investment markets around the world on tenterhooks. We'll find out more from our partners at Bloomberg what's happening in the last few minutes. Also coming up today, Sean Summers, Chief Executive of Pick and Pay. Makoni Maja will be talking politics with the campaign manager at the Institute of Race Relations. And then Muzi Maimani, leader of BOZA, joins us. Muzi has been a great proponent for democracy in Southern Africa and surely will be celebrating after a party that ruled Botswana for 58 years has been ejected with just 4 seats out of 61. Seismic moves here in our part of the world. But before we go into the local information, let's get what's happening rest of the world, and particularly in the United States, where it seems most eyes are trained right now.
Multiple polls released on Sunday show a tight race between Vice President Harris and former President Trump, both nationally and in swing states. ABC News and Ipsos gives Harris a 49-46% edge nationally. The New York Times Siena survey shows Harris ahead in 5 of the 7 swing states. And the Des Moines Register shows Harris ahead in Iowa, 47-44. Former President Trump spoke at a rally earlier in Pennsylvania in response to the latest polling data.
They can make those polls sing. They can make them sing. They brag about it. I got a poll. I'm 10 points up in Iowa. One of my enemies just puts out a poll. I'm 3 down. Joni Ernst called me. Everyone's called me. They said, you're killing in Iowa. The farmers love me and I love them.
On to Florida, where Republican U.S. Senator Marco Rubio is defending former President Donald Trump following controversial comments made by a speaker at one of Trump's rallies. Speaking on CBS Face the Nation, Rubio downplayed the joke told by comedian Tony Hinchcliffe that Puerto Rico was garbage.
And a comedian made a joke and it was tasteless, but it wasn't Trump that said it. It wasn't, this guy's not going to be in his cabinet. I mean, this comedian's not going to be a member of his government. He's certainly not running for anything.
That was Florida Republican U.S. Senator Marco Rubio speaking to CBS Face the Nation. In China, lawmakers are gathering to sign off on a fiscal package worth trillions of yuan. This is the meeting of the Standing Committee of the National People's Congress. It's expected to unlock additional resources to take pressure off local governments and to recapitalize major state banks in China. Moldova's pro-Western president Maia Sandu has won a second term. Sandu had been in a pivotal presidential runoff against a Russian-friendly opponent in a race that was overshadowed by claims of Russian interference, voter fraud, and intimidation. Moldova is a candidate country for membership in the European Union. OPEC Plus has agreed to push back its December production increase by 1 month. This is the cartel's second delay to plans to revive supply as oil prices continue to struggle. The group is led by Saudi Arabia and Russia. It had intended to begin a series of monthly production increases by adding 180,000 barrels a day from December. But now, OPEC Plus will keep supply restrained through that month. No reason for the delay was given, but some analysts did expect the move. It appears intended to avoid unsettling markets in the front of the U.S. presidential election. Outside of the presidential election, markets have plenty to look out for in the week ahead, including a Fed policy meeting. We have a preview from Bloomberg's Karen Moscow.
It all begins Monday with a look at factory orders. Then Tuesday, we have the ISM Services Index. The Federal Reserve is out with an interest rate decision on Thursday, along with the Bank of England. The week October employment report may have kept the Fed on track to cut interest rates by a quarter point. Karen Moscow, Bloomberg Radio.
And last week's market moves on Friday, a big move in the U.S., recovering a lot of the ground that had been lost on Thursday. As you can see from your screen, though, the S&P 500 index still down just about 2% on the week, NASDAQ 2.15%. Some recovery there for Uber, 6.5% down on the week after being nearly 10% down on results. But the other big tech stocks were notable with declines. Amazon, however, was an improver on the week after those financial results that the market really liked. As far as South Africa is concerned, we mirrored what went on in other parts of the world on Friday. The JSE Top 40 index, about 1% stronger. The Rand gained 8 cents against the US dollar and lost 5 cents against the pound. And a welcome bit of relief there for Sasol, which is down, would you believe, nearly 50% this year so far. It's in the 40s. That 4.2% gain on Friday for Sasol has brought it back a little. But We Buy Cars, on the other hand, continues to roll. That company's stock is up nearly double on where you could have bought it when the offer, when it first came to market. Both We Buy Cars and Altron are the star performers on the JSE in the year to date. Capitec also had a good day on Friday, and it's had a wonderful year so far. On the way down, Karoo and Caxton. Well, David Shapiro is our man on the markets. Dave, we aren't really going to be talking about those minute moves, but before we go into the big story of the moment, which is the presidential election in America and the cut in interest rates potentially on Thursday, there was a set of results that came out from Sifaku. Now, I hadn't really been following Sifaku Cement, but it is part of the Dangote empire, or at least it's got some connection there. And we have been following Afrimat, which bought the cement factory in Lichtenberg. So it's quite promising to see Sifaku doing a bit better.
Alec, cement is a difficult industry to follow at the moment. We've had the imports. We're not getting the investment that we would like to keep those going. Alec, there's another important point as well. Globally, there's a shift away from cement to other kind of bonding agents. You know, if you look at the big buildings that are going up globally, they're not being put up by bricks and mortar. Huh? So I think we have to have a deep dive into this industry. In Africa, it probably still is relevant, but I think over the long term, things are changing, even the way that they make bricks. And so I think this is something we've got to look at. We're not getting the spending. We're not getting the bridges being built here. We're not getting the development. So for that side of the industry, it remains very difficult. You know, even if you look at PPC's results, yes, they slightly improved. You can get some kind of insights from cash builders as well, whether the bucky builders are buying those bags of cement. But, you know, when you say you haven't looked at it, I think somewhere along the line, we actually have to say, okay, what is the future of cement? You know, where does this fit in, given the technological developments in building globally? The way that they put up houses now, you know, almost like Lego sets. So I watch it from that point of view. Uh-huh. I watch very carefully to see what demand is like, you know, especially through cash build and through PPC.
So cement's all going to be about infrastructure. If the government starts investing in the country, rebuilding the country in infrastructure, then cement will be okay. Something that you do look at, that we've both looked at over many years, is Tongaat. I picked up on Friday, there was a monthly report that the business rescue practitioners put out every month. On Friday, it brought 2 years. It's now 2 years since Tongaat went into business rescue. And I just got the feeling, reading through those pretty arcane kind of reports that they were doing, there wasn't a heck of a lot that's happened in the past month. And what would worry entrepreneurs or people who look at business is when business rescue practitioners get involved, they don't have much incentive to be urgent. I didn't see any urgency in that because they're just getting paid anyway. Dave, is there any hope for Tongaat?
There has to be. It's not even questionable. You know what I mean? It's not, when I say there has to be hope, for the simple reason of the number of people that they employ in KZN and around the country. So you can't let this go. I mean, you can't let this collapse. So somewhere along the line, there's got to be a little bit of a push to say we have to get it done. And in some cases, as we've seen in the past with South Africa, you know, we've seen it with many businesses where maybe the banks should also become involved. You know, they've also got a duty. You know, the banks like to take a step backwards and not take any risk. I'm not a pro-banker person. You know, I don't think they do enough. They're always too cautious. But somewhere along the line, they have to realize what the collapse of this company, final collapse, you know, would mean. Yes, we don't want outsiders coming in, you know, who are opportunists. But on the other hand, something has to be done. So, again, it's another story we watch with great interest simply because of the huge number of people that are employed. You know, and these are low-level workers. You know, these are very low-level workers. You can't afford to let them go for whatever they do. So, Alec, it's another one of these stories that we have to watch carefully. Both those are substructures. You know, they're important. Cement, sugarcane, very important for our economy. Even though they're smaller businesses, from an employment point of view, yes.
Dave, I know no question to you is off limits. And I've had a few people prodding me and saying, ask Shapiro what's going on with Sasfin. We did cover it a while ago. Show, man, it's second time round for you. I remember the Corp Capital thing you got sucked into.
I've had a few.
Well, you've had a long career.
Corp Capital to this one. they've done the deal now with African banks, so I think the money will come in and support them. But I'm on the wealth side. And from our point of view, we've done very well. And, they will delist and you will find two businesses coming in. The big debate is whether we change the name or not, you know, whether we stay with Sasfin or rebrand. But I think that will happen in the new year. You know, my business continues. And there's nothing else I could do. Just put my head down and keep looking at the market. Unfortunately, everything else is out of my control. But it's been destabilizing, and people read the headlines. You know, we can't ignore that, Alec. It's something in every business. You have to address it. You know, you have to address the headlines. But I'm okay. I can still afford fresh bread on Fridays. You
know, so. And so can your clients. We know that you look after them well. Dave, is it something that your clients are talking about with the U.S. presidential election? I'm going to miss Trump's crazy one-liners if he doesn't get elected. Well, if he gets elected, we're probably going to hate those crazy one-liners. But, I don't care about the polls. Polls are all wrong. I'm 10 points ahead, not 4 points behind. He really does put quite a lot of spice into this. But as The Economist said last week, he also brings huge risk. And The Economist said, rather vote for Kamala because the risks that Trump will bring to the party are lower than her deficiencies. Deficiencies.
Yeah. I think he's lowering the bar of America. You know, he's bringing it down a notch. He evokes or promotes violence. You know, he promotes disunity globally. He promotes everything that you don't want in a president. I don't think we've ever seen a president who is so vindictive ever. You know, if you look at American politics, and I like to read history. If I always get the view from my daughter who's in Boston, you know, and her friends, and they're not mad about Kamala. They don't think she's the brightest star in the sky. But I think, nor do they like Trump. And they lean towards Kamala not because they like her or, funny enough, the woke Democratic policies. You know, you've got to understand those as well. But I think she's a calming force. You know, she buys time for the Republican Party to reposition itself, also for the Democrats to look at herself. I don't think she's going to be a great president. I don't, from that point of view, if she isn't. But I think globally we need, Alec, we want a period of calm. You know, I think we're tired of what we've seen in the world, whether it's Ukraine, whether it's the Middle East and that. And hopefully, I think a president like Kamala will just help, you know, bring us onto a clear path or a decent path. He's very odd man, you know. He's very strange.
You wonder what
comes out of his mouth, you know. He's
wonder what Abraham Lincoln, who is probably the greatest American president, would have thought of a man like Donald Trump. It's just so different. I've read biographies and the Team of Rivals, it's just like in a different league. But I suppose, things have moved on.
You know what's interesting is in those days, Lincoln was a Republican.
Exactly.
The opposition were Democrats, you know, which is the strange thing about American politics. But you're dead right. And you know, if you read about Washington and Jefferson and that era, these were huge men. Yes, they might have been slave owners at the time, you know, this is the late 1700s and that. But they had a moral compass which everybody wanted to follow. You know, they were very moral people. They knew when to pull out. They knew when to go when their time was up. Nothing like this. Yes, there have been some really rotten American presidents along the way, but I don't think anybody that matches Mr. Trump.
Well, Rob Herzog reckons Trump will win. I see Daniel Princely has just posted a note there to say that Rob should get all his wealthy friends and Trump to invest in South Africa. It's not that easy, is it, Dave?
No. I think we need Kamala. You know, I don't think it's going to be good for us if Trump comes in. You know, he doesn't take any prisoners, and I think Cyril will have to really kind of crawl in on all fours to beg forgiveness, you know, for supporting who he does, for cozying up to the Iranians and so on. He doesn't suffer people like that. And Americans in general don't. You know, they don't like people who are enemies of the nation. So I think South Africa will have to reposition its point. You know, it'll have to reposition itself if Trump does come in, if we want relationship with the U.S.
David Shapiro is with Sasfin Wealth. I think we need to say that more often, and his organization not being contaminated by the issues that happened at Sasfin. I spoke with David Bacher, as I always do at the end of the month, to pick up on the major movements of the stock market. Here's a little clip. You can watch the full interview on BizNews TV, but here's a little clip from our conversation on Friday.
US Treasury yields went up a massive 50 basis points, and the bond market is probably the most efficient telling market in the world. And when they move quite quickly, it does investors take note. And when inflation came in a bit hotter, we spoke about the deficits a bit earlier, you know, higher US Treasury yields really mean that the market is worried about inflation. It means that interest rates are unlikely to be cut as much as everyone expected. And, you know, when your interest rate expectations start to be more conservative, that has an impact on equity markets. And that was, we believe, the main driver for October and why markets across the board struggled.
And for those who aren't quite understanding the nuances here, interest rates, higher interest rates are a reflection of investors saying the risk is more. It's a bit like, David, if you are a guy who's been unemployed and you go to the bank and you ask them to lend you money, they might lend you money, but they're going to charge you a higher interest rate because you're a bigger risk of not repaying that money than someone perhaps who's getting a steady income. Is that a fair parallel?
That certainly is. And there's also other examples of why interest rates are so important for the investment community. So as you said, higher interest rates makes it more difficult for consumers to borrow, makes it more difficult for consumption and spending from consumers. They have to tighten their belts. That affects corporates, and that obviously ends to potentially affecting companies' profitability, and hence share markets don't like it. But there's also, from a valuation perspective, when you have higher interest rates and you, as an investor, what you're trying to do is take future earnings and discount them back to today's value. When you're using higher interest rates, those values come down. So lower interest rates, just from a valuation perspective, is also a big driver in terms of how investors feel.
Well, isn't that interesting from David Bacher? We had the two Davids so far. We got a Sean coming in now, Sean Summers, who is the CEO of Pick and Pay. Sean, lovely to be able to finally catch you. Although I believe from your email back, you're like me. You're a member at least of the 5 a.m. club, in office by 6 a.m. You've got a strong work ethic, always have, and I guess you need it right now with Pick and Pay.
Well, somebody has to put the croissants in the oven early, Alec. They don't just pop out miraculously at 8 o'clock, all warm and beautiful.
Well, somebody has really been at it, and congrats on the deal that you struck with First Rand or FNB on e-bucks. It kind of got lost somewhere in the news flow of last week, but having read that, It's a big win for Pick and Pay if you consider what you're up against with Checkers and so forth. Just unpack what it means and how you put it together.
I think it's a huge win for us, Alex. And as you say, you know, some things get lost in the news cycle, although everything appears to get lost in the news cycles these days. There's just so much information around, and one's just really got to dial out the noise and just stay really focused on your North Star. Just keep sort of moving on. So the FNB e-bucks thing is massive. It is a huge hib. I mean, it's the most popular loyalty scheme that is in the country. They distributed about $2.4 billion to their clients last year as part and parcel of that. And it's the start of a journey for us with them. We've got some very, very exciting stuff that we're working on in the background that will be revealed in the next couple of months. And a lot of these things have to be technologically enabled first, as you understand, you know, just to get these devices to work at the end of the day. And some of the things that we're going to be launching just takes a little bit of time. But it's off to a great start already. And I think it's going to be wonderful for us going forward. And it's just great to see the confidence that FNB have placed in Pick and Pay and our turnaround.
Does it mean, Sean, that if I have e-bucks with First National Bank account, that I can come into Pick and Pay and use those to buy product?
Absolutely. You can burn your e-bucks in Pick and Pay with effect from the 1st of November in both Pick and Pay stores and Pick and Pay clothing. So Pick and Pay clothing for their top-tier clients, they can get up to 20% off. And this is basically the relationship that FNB has built up with its clients over a period of time. I mean, e-bucks have been going on for over 20 years. You know, it was started when Paul Harris was still back in the day there. And it's just an extraordinary scheme, and it's wonderful for us.
How did you land it, though? Because FNB has got the whole world that it can choose from. You are going through, as you said, a turnaround. It's tough times. We saw that in your interims last week. So how did you get them to believe the story?
I think, you know, Alex, when I say one of the difficulties, I mean, obviously they have sight of what's going on behind, because on the other side of the wall, they are also significant funders of ours in the RMB process. And if you have a look at the current listings and the rights offer, so they certainly have good look through as to where we are and dial out the noise. Because, you know, one of the issues, Alec, and I mean, you're in this game yourself, you know, it's all about eyeballs and clicks at the end of the day for a lot of the media. So you just got to get rid of all of the nonsense headlines that one reads today, the clickbait stuff. They've got a good view under the hood of where Pick and Pay is, what the journey is that we are on, and what the trajectory is. We still have a very significant base in the company. I mean, we're in excess of $100 billion enterprise. So when you read all of these stories about, oh, Pick and Pay can't stand a chance, it hasn't got the scale, ShopRite Checkers are growing at this pace, you know, sure, all of those things are realities in the sideline, but you have to ask, what does it really mean commercially at the end of the day? I mean, I use my best example. You know, my finest retail chain in the world today is Wegmans in America. And I mean, Wegmans is not size-wise even in the top 15 chains in America. There may be 12 or 13, yet they run the finest business. And for us, you know, that's our pursuit, is to get back to running a quality operation. From next year, we'll be in a situation that we'll be able to start reinvesting in our very, very beautiful geographic fleet of stores that we have. And I mean, we've still got some extraordinary centers that we're in, but that are just terribly underinvested. And, you know, part and parcel of that journey is not only rehabilitating the stores, it's about rehabilitating the people as well. You know, it's a year ago since I walked into this building. And, you know, I always use the analogy, you know, when I came back here a year ago, I sadly couldn't find a pulse. You know, most people were working from home. It was still the tail end of that sort of era. And Lorena and a couple of the finance people who were sitting here like deers in the headlight trying to just sort of keep things turning over. But for the balance, there really was no pulse in the company. I mean, I had a supplier last week who said to me, Sean, you need to know this. He said, it's been more than a decade since I've walked into your buyer's offices and gone around the company and heard laughter and positivity and people talking about the future. And he said, you just need to know it. I just wanted to share it with you. So I said to him, well, thank you very much, because, you know, those are the things really at the end of the day that get you through these times and actually develop more character and make us stronger. So I think at FNB certainly have seen the change in cadence in the organization. They've been around to see it firsthand, and we're very honored that they've joined us and we've been allowed to join them.
We've been talking to Evan Walker from 361, who you know very well, he's been giving us some really good insights over the past few days about Pick n Pay and the retail landscape. But the one thing he did point out was that Boxer has been a sensational business, and it's part of Pick n Pay. So I guess for outsiders to say, but hang on, you've got on the one side, Sean's got this struggling ship. On the other side, within the organization, there's a superstar. What went wrong between the two of them?
I think it, you know, if you look at Boxer, Alec, and I mean, I've told this story 100 times. I mean, some 22 years ago, I pursued Pat Goss and then Hugh Bland, who was running Boxer and the Clarks, and eventually we bought it 22 years ago, thank heavens. So it's rather ironic to return and have Boxer kind of save the day for us. But Boxer has always been run as a completely freestanding business. You know, the team were always left completely on their own, and it was kept that way. So, you know, they've been allowed to grow from the just under 40-odd stores that we bought in those days, which we paid 180-odd million rand then, and to grow it into the business that it is today. I mean, they opened their 500th store last week, and it's just been an extraordinary journey. And the view that we had originally then was that for that market, one needed to have a very, very focused business to attract and actively compete in a day-to-day basis in that market. Completely different overhead structure. And that's why it's been kept on that basis. And, you know, good luck to them, and it's been fantastic. You know, to go through, as I always preached here in the office a long time ago when I came back, guys, nobody has a rear-view mirror here because I'm really not interested in yesterday. When you come into my office and sit down, I want to know, what are you doing today, tomorrow, next week, next year, next month? Because that's where it's at. So to come and tell me who did what or didn't do really doesn't help, other than I need to have context as to how we arrived here so that we don't repeat some of the same behaviors. But for the team, it's all about focusing on tomorrow and just keeping your head down and ignore the noise.
Is Pat Goss still involved in Boxer?
No, Pat. When we bought the business, he sat on the board for a while. Pat was off and out the business a long time ago. But as Pat is Pat, I mean, he still keeps in regular contact with Marek and the team at Boxer. So absolutely, you know, but he's not involved in a day-to-day basis.
So Sean, for those who are now trying to understand Pick n Pay better, when Boxer is separately listed, will Pick n Pay still own some of it? Is Pick n Pay going to get money that will liquidate debt on the Pick n Pay side? And is there a risk of throwing good money after bad?
No. And here we have to be very guided and careful in what we say, as you well understand, you know, all of the various statements and documents and PLSs out there. So what will happen is, and this is what we've articulated to the market, is that we will raise in the upper end of the 6 to 8 billion of cash, which will go in on top of the 4 billion that was raised in the rights offer. And then what that does at a Pick n Pay level is that we will maintain a controlling shareholding in Boxer. So it will still be a subsidiary, basically, of the company. It will be a listed entity, but we will maintain the controlling shareholding there. And then what that does is it completely reshapes Pick n Pay's balance sheet. We will be sitting with strong cash on hand on our balance sheet as at the end of this year, all things being equal. If the markets remain as fairly consistent as they are at the moment, we will get that away. And it therefore means that from next year on, we will then be able to start entering back into a cycle of redeploying capital into the core Pick n Pay business. Up until now, all of the capital we've had I've given to Boxer and to clothing, because that's been our two primary growth engines. And this year for us in Pick n Pay has been one of stabilization, Alec. It's been one of getting to grips with a very complex 11-bank lender group and having to manage that dynamic and get that dealt with, deal with the two corporate actions that we have had on the go. And then next year is just going to be an extraordinary year for us, because we'll really get into a situation that we can then start supporting our newly created management team under the leader of Dallas. And Dallas is heading up our core Pick n Pay business in South Africa. And I mean, we're already seeing a lot of trajectories and things moving in the right direction there. And it's every day, you know, one just wants to see the cadence just increasing solidly, steadily. You know, this is not about any sort of one day blip up and then back down again. It's just about consistently building the momentum back into the business again.
What's the reaction been like from investors that you've spoken to on the interim results?
It's been nothing but hugely positive. It's almost like a parallel world. You know, when I walked out of the auditorium last Monday, having done the results presentation, and the people that were in the room, well, the analysts who are sitting there really sort of tearing all of the numbers to pieces, and everybody standing there saying, wow, we cannot believe what's happened in a year. We cannot believe how all of these plans have come in place. And, you know, then you come to your office and then you start reading all of the silly little headlines that are out there in a lot of these online publications, which is just going for clicks at the end of the day and getting eyeballs. And you kind of read it. I mean, I had the one young lady, I did media interviews the entire day. And so the one young lady, when I came on the phone, was gushing and glowing about unbelievable results, great stuff and what have you. And I said, well, it certainly doesn't reflect in the headline that you've written in an article. You know, so she just sort of said, well, you know, yeah, it is what it is. You know, I don't write the headlines. My editor does. And you know, I mean, you've been in this industry your whole life. And especially now in this online world, you know, this media space kind of goes from somebody on TikTok who's got an audience of maybe 1,000 or 1,500 people making crazy comments all the way through to YouTubers who got a bit of noise. And so, yeah, that's why I say, Alec, you just got to dial it out at the end of the day. You've got to deal with the stuff that's of substance and just keep your eye on the prize and go forward. What we will also have in the balance sheet is the cash on hand that we know that we will continue to burn in the next while as we move back to getting into profitability again. This company was severely and seriously debilitated. And if anybody thought this was going to be easy and it was just going to be a walk in the park, it never was. I said within the first week of coming back that this would be a multi-year journey, that sadly, in my tummy, I felt that things would get worse before they got better because I could see that from the numbers as well. And that's what those results are a manifestation of. But I can quietly and confidently say that the worst is behind us. And the really big stuff that we've had to deal with is largely dealt with. And it's now just a solid journey over the next 18, 24 months of getting ourselves back into the sunshine again. So the amounts of money that we've set aside to get ourselves there, that's all taken care of in the current planning and capital structures that are there. So onwards we go.
Sean Summers, Chief Executive of Pick and Pay. And if you recall, Sean was also one of our speakers at the last BizNews conference. Remember, the next one's coming up in March next year. I think we've got at least as strong a lineup from the 11th to the 13th of March in Hermanus. Hope you could join us then. Well, on to politics now, and we're going to be talking to Makoni Maja in just a little while. But before that, every Sunday, my colleague Chris Stain gets together for a chat with Neil De Beer. Neil keeps breathing fire. And my goodness, this week he was bedonned about the National Prosecuting Authority dropping its criminal charges against pretty much anybody, it seems, in the ANC who's got some political influence. Let's pick up with Chris and Neil. Remember, you can watch the full interview or listen to it on BizNews TV and BizNews Radio.
Talking about accountability for corruption or alleged corruption, Neil, the former Minister of Arts, Culture, Sports, Arts and Culture, Mr. Zizi Kodwa, appears to be overhook on corruption charges. What do you think is happening at the National Prosecuting Authority?
Nothing. Not enough. Chris, may I read a list? And this list is a list that indicts, in my opinion, the balance between prosecution of citizen and the prosecution of people that are politically enclosed. I'm going to read a list here. Dudu Zani Zuma, case withdrawn. The Gupta, the Dairy Freda investigation, withdrawn. Mashele Koko, case withdrawn and thrown out. Zizi Kodwa, case dismissed and withdrawn. Brian Molefe, charges withdrawn. Malusi Gigaba, charges withdrawn. And Zandile Gumede, charges withdrawn. And lately, Pala Pala, Cyril Ramaphosa, charges withdrawn. Chris, that is 8 cases, just out of the top of my head that I investigated, where physically there is tantamount evidence that these people can be prosecuted, but the NPA has withdrawn. Now, on the latest bit with Zizi Kodwa, which is a predominantly top 20 member of the ANC, goes to court, gets charged, and then the NPA comes back last week and says, but they don't think that they will have enough evidence to prosecute that word. Doesn't that sound familiar? A day after, though, there is such a knee-jerk reaction that the Hawks apparently contacted the NPA and said, can you please look at this again? Whereas the Hawks are actually part of the police but are in the investigative scenario. Chris, this is blatant. Now, maybe I'm in La La Land. Miskien het ek 'n bietjie wakker geword die mekaar. This is not right, because what you can see, it's a pattern of political coverage and political interference. I would love to be a prosecutor that sits down, and I'm not saying all. We have got very, very good prosecutors in this country. But I think when you look at this, I'm sorry, this is starting to become an algorithm that I am not comfortable with in this country, that political people are, in my opinion, being said by a crystal ball. I would love to have that crystal ball. Give me the lotto number, 2665779, the bonus ball is 10, that you can say that there's no hope in hell that you're going to be absolutely positive that you can get a criminal account or a conviction against a certain person. This is not the law. So it seems, again, that George Orwell, in his great scenario of Animal Farm, is becoming again infused in our politics, where it says everybody should be equal. Some are just more equal than others, Chris.
Yeah. Neil De Beer talking about the NPA. There's a heck of a lot more in the Sunday chat from yesterday. But Makoni Maja joins us now. She is a campaign manager at the Institute for Race Relations. Makoni, lovely to have you back on Mondays. And let's start with Neil. Your take on the whole NPA story of not following through on what appears to be compelling evidence.
Thank you so much for having me again, Alec. It really is concerning to see that there have been so many botched jobs with respect to prosecutions of very high profile cases with respect to the state capture. You had, as far back as August, I believe, the Ministry of Justice coming out and saying that state capture evidence itself is under risk because there was a technical issue with the database that may render the evidence inaccessible, which effectively means that all that money that we dedicated to the state capture commission of Zondo may effectively be rendered useless. All that money, all the time that was spent going into investigating those possible crimes, basically going down the drain. It really does worry, especially when you think about South Africa on the grey list and how we reportedly have addressed about 16 of the roughly 23 items that the FATF had required that we address in attempts to get off that grey list. But there's still some of the crimes, financial crimes, that we haven't dealt with. And I think there's substantial evidence to demonstrate that state capture is quite linked to some of those financial crimes that we haven't yet addressed, which means we could be on that grey list for a much longer period, because the government has indicated that the remaining items, the majority of them have been addressed, the remaining ones are quite sticky. They require a lot more time to deal with. So I am quite concerned and share the grievances that Mr. De Beer fervently expressed.
I was thinking over the weekend ahead of this discussion and having watched what Neil De Beer had to say about whether the DA did a clever thing by going into partnership with the ANC. Because there must be many people saying, but hang on, if the DA had rather gone into partnership with the others, in other words, the ANC only had 40%, and then started addressing the rot where it lies, we might have had, or we might have a better country. Clearly, this is academic at the moment. You can't see the DA pulling out of the government of national unity, and there would be all kinds of repercussions on the international markets were that to happen. But in the long term, would that not be something that somebody's thinking about? Because as deeply as the ANC influences are embedded in the system, it seems as though what Neil's complaining about might be perpetuated.
I agree with you in that I was and still am a GNU, not naysayer per se, but I'm doubtful of its success initially for ideological reasons. But when you speak about the DA perhaps remaining in something like the Rainbow Coalition and strengthening their position, you know, consolidating positions of those different parties so that they stand stronger and mount a greater defense in the next local government election, it really could have changed South Africa sustainably, right? Because the GNU addresses a few of South Africa's hot button issues, but in the long term, we should be looking at building a side in parliament that can stand against whether it's the ANC or the Progressive Caucus, members of the Progressive Caucus, who I suspect if the ANC hadn't gone into the GNU with the DA, would have gone with your EFFs and MKs and other members of the Progressive side. So I agree with you that had they remained in the Rainbow Coalition, they could have been able to sustainably change how votes are cast in parliament when motions of no confidence against a president are brought up. Although I should say that Palapala pales in comparison to things like state capture. And I'm not sure that keeping the DA out of the GNU on grounds of addressing corruption would have necessarily been an effective strategy, because they've only agreed to not support the motion of confidence against the president. But I believe they would vote against somebody, even somebody like a Minister of Justice, Simelane, who herself has had corruption charges made against her.
It is such an interesting scenario, and I'm grateful for your input onto this. Moving on to an interview I had last week with Celia Brink from Tshwane. He had some pretty hectic things to say about Herman Mashaba. And Mashaba, he was responding to Mashaba's interview with Chris, where he said that Joburg is in much better shape than Tshwane or Pretoria. What's your take on that? Is that just both of them playing politics, or where does the truth lie? The IRR does a huge amount of research into this kind of stuff.
We do. I think currently both the municipalities are in a lot of trouble. We've recently produced a report profiling the Gauteng looming water crisis, as we call it, just addressing what some of the problems are and what solutions specifically Gauteng residents should be looking at deploying to defend themselves against what could really look like Cape Town's own day zero, marginal escape of day zero. So I do think that they are, both the cities are in a substantial amount of trouble, although visibly Johannesburg is in greater decay than the city of Tshwane. And so I think perhaps for residents of Johannesburg, it's in a much worse condition just driving around Joburg CBD in comparison to the Tshwane CBD. There's a big differences as different as day and night, right? But I think there are still a lot of issues that both of those municipalities need to address, specifically with respect to the water crisis. So on that account, I'd say they're both playing politics, because they are both facing very great problems should this water crisis materialize.
R.W. Johnson had some rather pointed things to say about it, that in a piece of his last week. He says Joburg's a dying city. It just doesn't have the water to be able to be sustained. And I guess the fact that governance is so poor would heighten that risk. With that research that you did, what would it take to turn this around?
So we need to increase our water capacity. Mr. Johnson is right in that South Africa is generally a water-scarce country. But one of the remarks we make in the report is that much like many of the parts of the world that are scarce in natural resources, you can make up for that with good planning and a good management of those very important materials. And we're just not seeing that, whether it was with load shedding or with the potential water shedding. The government is just not making plans for the increase in population, which Gauteng has substantially increased since the water resources were first built. So yes, the Vaal Dam is running out of water. South Africa's also just not had sufficient rainfall to carry the requisite demand for water. But also you've seen the Lesotho Highlands project, which was supposed to support the Vaal Dam, being deferred by about 8 years. This was a treaty between the South African and the Lesotho government that was going to see us being provided with water. So yeah, Gauteng, Johannesburg really is in a lot of trouble. And what we're considering is some of the legal action that can be taken to compel municipalities to at least address the leakages, because the leakages are accounting for some 30 to 40% water losses. This is potable, safe drinking water that's just being lost to poor and non-action on maintaining the pipeline and water network infrastructure. So we're looking at ways in which we can begin to compel those municipalities to perform the requisite maintenance. You had one of the municipalities in Johannesburg indicates that of the 42 reservoirs they have in place, they only have a budget to maintain 20 of the leakages of those 42. I mean, that is unacceptable. So there's just not, there's a lack of political will, I would say, on the part of these municipalities to really address those issues. But it's a perfect time for residents to get involved. Water affects us directly, just as electricity did. And there's no reason for us to sit on our laurels and expect that things would change. We should really take up action.
Makhoni, bringing in Musi Maimane now, the leader of BOZA. Musi, I hear you on the line. I have Makhoni Maja with us. She's campaign manager at the IRR, and I'd like her to also listen in and maybe ping a question or two. But let's just go back a little bit, Musi. At one of the BizNews conferences, you were talking to us about H.H. Chilima and how what had happened in Zambia was going to happen in other parts of SADC. And my goodness, if we look at the Botswana election over the weekend, it does appear to be a triumph for democracy. Why were you so confident that this could happen?
Well, good morning. And firstly, I think it should be a celebrated result. And I also applaud the outgoing president, Masisi, for the way in which he's accepted the results. But I think what's an important dynamic is that most liberation movements fail the test of governance and the time period that you could kind of indicate that to is somewhere near 30 years or so. And when change occurs within a region, often you find it sweeps through. We can almost take a period before that. You can remember with Samora Machel, Yvette, Robert Mugabe, etc., was a period of liberation where countries were starting to be liberated. And I think as the region starts to recognize the fact that what the next fight is going to be is for leaders with strong governance records, it is natural that they are going to reject liberation movements whose main argument is that we freed you, almost as a thesis, but ultimately the danger is that they themselves become oppressors of the people, as you are seeing in Zimbabwe. So citizens begin to reject that after a number of years. And so we are seeing it. We saw it in Malawi with Lazarus Chakwera. We are seeing it. We saw it in Zambia. You saw it now in Botswana. And it is natural that even here in South Africa, whether you might be at celebrate the GNU, but in some ways, there is a rejection by 60% of the electorate of the ANC. And therefore, that tells you that this wave of a change away from liberation movements is going to grip our region.
I guess something that also struck me about the Botswana results was that they don't have proportional representation as we do in South Africa. So the party that lost 61 seats in total, they only got 4 seats, the former rulers for the last 58 years. Yet they still got 30% of the vote. Whereas the party that won, the Umbrella for Democratic Change, they got 37% of the vote. So not a heck of a lot more than the BDP. But they got 36 seats and, of course, the president. So my question really is, in South Africa, we have proportional representation, which in a way, I guess, might be, at this point, playing against the removal of the Liberation Party, which, as we were talking earlier in the program today, has still got lots of issues, not least, it appears as if you're politically correct, connected, you are immune to prosecution from the NPA. What's your thought on that, Muzi?
Yeah, and that's why I've been fighting so hard for an electoral system that affects more accountability, even at a constituency-based level. You are correct that Botswana has got multiple constituencies, and therefore, naturally, what that constituency-based system also assists us is that you can pre-coalesce. Now, I was involved in Botswana a number of years ago dealing with the Umbrella for Democratic Change, of which the UDC became a part of, the Botswana People's Party was a part of, and a number of parties formed this umbrella. What they could do is they could do it ahead of an election because they could say, you are strong in this constituency, therefore we are going to pull off all troops and your candidate can go through. We are strong there. Will you support us there? Which helps. And ultimately, even now, Duma Maboko, whom I know very well, had in the last election battled in his own constituency, and now he's gone ahead and worked harder back there to win the trust of the people, etc. So to me, I think it does pass many of the democratic tests of allowing every individual member of parliament to be held accountable to someone. Now, I think South Africa will never get to a pure constituency-based system, but we may get to a 300-100, where you've got 300 constituencies and 100 proportionally represented people. The other most crucial thing is that there is a direct election of the president, which SADC countries have. That's how HH got into office, regardless of what happens in some instances, some of the popular vote, because it requires them to be able to mobilize the parliament to pass legislation. But at least the president, whoever the president is, knows that they are accountable to the people first. So when coming back to the case of South Africa, yes, the proportional system becomes limiting in that even now, despite the fact that, sure, the ANC has lost the outright majority, it can coalesce to be able to reform that majority. But that doesn't need to be a permanent feature. It requires us to ultimately ensure that even if you belong to a party, let the citizens know who you are, directly vote for you, so they can hold you accountable. Because Botswana, even if you may not even like who won or who didn't win, but at least accountability was effected in that country.
Mokoni, I'd like you to, I'm sure you've got lots of questions for Musi. We haven't got that much time left with him. But Musi, my big question for you is the ANC does appear to be operating just as it was doing before. Before it went down to 40% of the vote. If you were still the leader of the Democratic Alliance, would you have done this deal of the Government of National Unity?
It is a very difficult question because compared to what is the question, right? And I think part of the success of the GNU is reliant on the fact that the alternative, in some instances, you would then have to form a much bigger coalition that combines EFF, MK, etc. So I think I would have done, what I would have done though, is done it a little bit more differently. I would have forced a direct coalition with the ANC. But more seriously, if I was to do that, there are some policy issues that needed to be fought for or that government doesn't stand. My greatest worry now is to your point, the ANC, all it's done, it's lost its numbers, augmented with the DA and added a few cabinet ministers with the patronage that goes with it, and there's been silence. It is outstanding to me that the DA still stands strongly on the ANC, something they opposed, race-based legislation. They've gone for it now. They're defending it in all corners. A bloated cabinet, a bloated civil service. All of these, when I looked at the tabling of the budget this week, it may be a balancing act, but in all reality, it lacks a very strong reform economic plan. It's more of the same, to your point. It's not just around corruption that the ANC or anything like that has kept going. It's also about issues such as how do we ensure that there's an economic reform? And I haven't seen any of the DA or any other party's economic policy finding any expression, even in the financing of the issue. So to me, I think if you were going to force the issue, you needed to make sure that it is foreground on policy rather than personality or party.
Makoni?
Hi, Musi. Let me ask you a very direct question about the budget that you've just spoken about. One of the ways in which the Minister of Finance spoke about freeing up some 2 billion rand in the fiscus is by incentivizing early retirement of members of the public servants, which is within the ages 55 to 59. I'm wondering what your position on that. It seems to me that there's a storm that could possibly be brewing with respect to trade unions obviously getting ready to protest and march against that, which we obviously don't need in South Africa at present. I'm wondering what your position is on that specific idea of the ministers.
Yeah, look, I think the protests issues will emerge from a different source in the sense that the budgeting process in how it has factored in the midterm, some of the budget increases. Our fiscus is built on the fact that increases in the next number of years can only be at 4%. Now, were it to be that any negotiating agent in public service could go above that, then your problems could become compounded almost seriously. On the retirement process, I do think it's a welcome thing. You need to make sure that where best you can, where there have been people who have stayed in public service for too long and you want them to be out, it's a voluntary scheme, so people must be able to exercise that. And there are a lot of people who say they can't work in the current administration, etc., so therefore they are wanting to go. So from that perspective, I think it is the right thing to do from a budgeting point of view and to allow for those who want to exit to go and for departments who want to exercise voluntary exits, etc., to do that. Because in the same way as you saw perhaps maybe in the transition in 94, there were other civil servants who said, I don't quite like the new configuration, etc., I'm wanting to exit the system. Mm-hmm. They were allowed to do so with enough packages. And I think that's part of that moment right now that we're living through. My deep worry, as I said to you earlier, is what do we do in an event where a particular union extracts, particularly in municipalities, they extract a lot more than the budget at 4% in terms of increases going forward, given that inflation is high, given that the economic challenges we're facing. I think you could see a lot more headwind coming that way because the state simply can't afford an increase beyond 4%.
Muzi Maimane is the leader of BOZA. We've also had Makoni Maja from the Institute for Race Relations with us today in that discussion. I would remind you all, though, Tito Mboweni tried the same trick and in fact, he made a huge incentive, and he even worked it into his budget that he would get many of the civil servants by incentivizing them to retire, that they would go, and none of them did. He had to come back the next year when he was finance minister and say, oops, didn't work. Well, if you've got a cushy job like some people have in government and where urgency is not on the top of the priorities, a little bit like, as I said earlier with David Shapiro, with the business rescue managers at Tongaat, urgency certainly doesn't seem to be on top of their priorities either because the incentives are different. Well, then why would you retire? Why would you take early retirement? It's been the Biz News Briefing. I'm Alec Hogg. It's a great pleasure to be with you. From our technical producer, Ruan Erasmus, our executive producer, Lucy Ferreira, and the team at Biz News, Until tomorrow at 7 a.m. Cheerio.